Hare Krishna.
So I'm grateful to be here amongst all of you today at the Lotus Feet of Radha Vrindavan Chandra. And I'll be speaking on the mind in two parts, today and tomorrow. How the mind messes our life, especially our relationships. So today I'll focus on understanding what the mind is and especially how the mind distorts our perceptions. And tomorrow I'll speak on how that distortion affects our relationships. So I spoke on the same topic a few days ago in Govardhanika village. How to understand the mind. So Chandramouli Maharaj was there. He says, first thing to understand the mind is that you can never understand the mind. The mind is too complex. So every analysis that we do, it is an approximation. Through different metaphors, through different analytical models, we try to gain some understanding of what the mind is. This verse is stating that actually the mind is controlled, then we don't need any of the pious and purificatory activities. But if the mind is not controlled, then of what use are these pious and purificatory activities? So, controlling and focusing the mind is vital for our well-being, not just spiritually, but even materially. So I'll take this in three parts. First is, we will look from the scriptural perspective what the mind is. Then look something from the contemporary psychological perspective, how the two perspectives gel with each other. And then we'll talk about how the distortion happens. So the mind is the essential link for the soul with the body. So the soul is the root of consciousness, R-O-O-T, and the mind is the root of consciousness, R-O-U-T-E. So the consciousness originates from the soul and is channeled through the mind. And whenever perception happens, at that time, three things have to be in line: the soul, the mind, and the particular sense. So for example, now, if you are hearing me, so at that time the soul has to be present in the body, the mind has to be there attentive, and then the ear has to be there. So if somebody is deaf, then they can't hear. But somebody may have a functional ear, but if they're absent minded, again they can't hear. So the soul, the ear, the mind, and the sensory organ, all three have to be in coordination for perception to take place. Now, the Bhagavad Gita in the 15th chapter, the 8th, 9th verse, it talks about the role of the mind in the transmigration of the soul. And there it states, 9th verse, Shrotram chakshu sparshanam cha rasanam ghranam eva cha adishthayam anashchayam vishayan upasevate. So it states that the senses, the ears, eyes, nose, skin and tongue, they are centered around the mind. So the mind integrates the input from the various senses and presents it for the soul to perceive. When I was in Florida, I was at a devotee jeweler's shop. And this devotee, he had three doors to his shop. And his office was upstairs. So he had a big monitor to which inputs were coming from the three doors. So there are cameras at each of the doors to see who is coming in. And all three were coming at one place. So if we imagine a big monitor where not three but five inputs are coming in. So if you have a big monitor, sometimes some advanced computers have split screens facility. So you can split the screen into two and two windows can be open. So imagine a big monitor on which five windows are open. So, in all these five windows, what is happening at that particular door can be seen. So, the senses are considered to be the doors to the body. Sarvadvareshu dehesmin prakasham pujayate jnanam yada tada vidyan vivruddham sattvamityuta. In 14.11, the Gita Krishna says that in the mode of goodness, these doors to the body, they are illumined. That means we can see what is coming in, what should be allowed to come in, what should not be allowed to come in. So basically, the senses are like the doors. And the mind is where what is going on at all these doors is integrated. So, if these five windows are open, you can say there are five windows within the monitor which are open, and say now if some suspicious looking character is coming in from a particular window, then you just click on that window and that window zooms up, and then the focus goes, oh, who is coming in? So similarly, say right now all of us are sitting and hearing. So if suddenly, maybe downstairs some delicious prasadam is being served and the fragrance comes up over here, so then what happens? The nose window zooms out and the whole consciousness gets focused on that. So in the earlier Krishna says in 2.67 that Indriyanam hi charatam yan mano anuvidhiyate tadasya harati pragyam vayurnavamimambasi. So the senses are roaming. Indriyanam hi charatam. They're observing, okay, what is at this door? What is at this door? What is at this door? And actually, this camera shows not just what is at the door, but through the door, it actually shows what is in the outer world also. So whichever catches our attention, that consumes our consciousness, that fills our mind. Now, as I said, the mind is very complicated to understand. So no metaphor is adequate. Why? Because there are not just five windows. You know, there can be actually within these five, there can be many more windows. So for example, say right now, I'm speaking. There's a sound is coming in through the sound window. But at the same time, if suddenly somebody screams behind, so what happens? Through the same sound window, something else is coming, but that catches our attention. So basically, whichever of the sense gives a forceful input, gives an attractive input, gives a captivating input, our consciousness focuses on that. That first of all occupies the mind. So we could say that the observer of this monitor is the soul, and the monitor itself is the mind. So many times we often say that, okay, if we analyze a little bit, we understand that we are not the body. The body keeps changing, but we don't change. So we are not the body. But how do we understand that we are not the mind? How do we learn that difference? So actually, in Western philosophy, the word mind is used generically to refer to anything beyond the physical level. So they often talk about mind-matter duality. So the mind means anything that is not matter. So the subtle mind, the soul, the supreme, everything is considered the level of the mind. So that's why they have two schools of thought. From the mind comes ideas. So there's materialism, which is the idea that matter is the primary reality. And the other is idealism. Idealism is not being ideal. It is the idea that ideas are the supreme reality. Thoughts, consciousness. So idealism. So the word mind is used in a different sense in the Western philosophy. Because to differentiate at the subtle level is quite difficult. How do I know? Okay, I understand there is something beyond the body. But within that, there is a mind, there is a soul. How do we differentiate that? So, for that, we can do a thought experiment. So, all of you can close your eyes. Try not to go to sleep. So, if you can just close your eyes for a minute. Now, take three deep breaths. Thank you. Now, with your closed eyes, you can see something on an inner screen. You might be seeing this temple, you might be seeing me, you might be seeing the prasad that is waiting for you after this. You might be seeing many things. There is a screen inside us on which images are formed. And this is like a stream of images which keeps coming and going. Now, as you are observing this stream of images, whatever it may be, or you may not be seeing anything also, just some dark pattern or blank pattern, but whatever it is that you are seeing, now try to take a step back and look at the seer. Who is it that is looking at that inner screen? You see something on your inner screen, but try to step back and look at who is there, who is watching that inner screen. take a step back and try to see. No matter how much you try to step back, we can't step back because the seer is what is doing the seeing. So what we are looking for is what we are looking with. So we can see the inner screen, but we can't see the inner seer. So the inner screen is the mind, and the inner seer is the source of consciousness beyond the mind. You can take 3 deep breaths and then you can open your eyes. Thank you. So the inner seer and the inner screen, these two things are there inside us. And the inner screen can keep changing. Many different things are seen on the inner screen. For example, when we dream, our eyes are closed. But there's an inner screen on which we see things. So the inner screen on which we see, that is the mind. That is the integrator of whatever is coming from the senses. So the inner seer and the inner screen are different. So sometimes this inner screen acts like a, especially when our eyes are closed or when we are absent-minded, the inner screen acts like a TV screen where we see something else apart from what is there in the outer world. So our consciousness gets transported somewhere else entirely. And in normal functioning, the inner screen acts like a window by which we see the outer world. So the inner screen can act both ways. It can act as a window to the world where we see the outer world, and it can act as a TV where our consciousness can be transported far away. So now when we talk about the inner screen, now I give these two examples, window and TV. That brings me to another aspect which complicates the understanding of the mind. The mind is like a monitor which doesn't just have 5 windows to it. It has a 6th window. The thoughts that arise within us, they arise either from outer perception or they arise from inner recollection. When they arise from inner recollection, sometimes there is nothing in our outer stimulus, but suddenly some thought comes, some desire comes. And suddenly we might remember, you know, I want to eat this, I want to watch this. Or this person did like that to me. How dare I do like that? So, at that time, there may be nothing in the outer perception that stimulates. But it is what comes in the mind can be from an inner recollection. So when this happens, there's outer perception and inner recollection. From both of these, thoughts can come in the mind. And when it comes from the inner recollection, at that time, the person gets more internal. More get internally absorbed or internally lost. So, internally absorbed means when one is consciously focusing on something. But lost means one is getting carried away by the thoughts without any conscious intention. So Prabhupada gives the example that if we have a pond of still water, in the pond bubbles may be formed in 2 ways. One is you throw a stone from outside, ripples are formed. Other is some fermentation happens inside and bubbles come up. So same way, from outer perception, certain image may be formed in the mind, certain ideas may be formed, or from inner recollection, certain things may come up. So this is the way we perceive things. So when we say somebody is absent-minded, you know, what does it mean? It's like, say, somebody puts up their specs on their head and they say, they're searching, where are my specs? Where are my specs? Searching everywhere. Now what is happening? The mind is always there. But the mind is not there in the head to sense, oh, there's a specs over here. So the mind is present somewhere else apart from where the body is present. And that's why that which is an obvious perception, that perception doesn't take place. So the mind is always there. But when you say the mind is absent, the mind is present somewhere else apart from the body. And that is what absent-mindedness is. So, when we perceive anything, we pursue through this mechanism of the body-mind complex. And some people are very good at certain things. Say some people are really very good at music. Some people come for kirtans and their nice music is going on. But somebody is very good, you know, one taal is a little offbeat, they can immediately sense it. Some people sing very well. Now if you take the, if you analyze the throat of a particular famous singer and the throat of an ordinary person, at a physical level, we may not find much difference. Maybe because of practice, the throat muscles are a little stronger. But the strength of the throat muscles does not produce the sweetness of the voice. So, you say, somebody, as I said, who has a very sharp ear, as we said, again, sharp ear for music. Now, it's not necessary that if you do a hearing test, not necessary that a person with a strong musical capability will score higher on hearing. So, some people, say, if somebody is a doctor, but they see a person, and yet they can make out, okay, you know, you got anemia, you got this, you got that. Now when they are seeing at that time, it's not necessary that their eyes are sharper in terms of the physical organs' capacity to see. You know, a lay person may have a 40x40 vision and a doctor may have a 40x40 vision. But the doctor is able to see more, not because of the capacity of the senses. Krishna says, Pashyanti Jnana Chakshusha. We see with the eyes of knowledge. That means comprehension. We see something and we make sense of something. Comprehension happens not just because of perception, but comprehension happens because of the education that accompanies perception. So, now where is this education or where is this specialization? As I said, somebody has a sharp ear for music. Now, some people may have practiced and then they have got a sharp ear. Some people are just born with amazing musical talent. Some children just at the age of 2-3, they pick a kartal and they start playing. And Srila Prabhupada was so small, his hands could barely reach across the mridanga, but he was playing a mridanga at that time. So, where does this capacity come from? Or where is this capacity situated? So, even the physical skills, say like playing music or singing or observing, dancing, these physical skills, the locus, the place where these physical skills are situated is not the sense particularly. The sense will have a role, the sensory organ will have a role in it. But this is actually situated in the subtle body. So, subtle body we could call broadly as the mind. Now, we can refer to subtle body as containing mind, intelligence, ego. That is a technical classification. But at a simple level, we can say there is matter, mind and consciousness. So, mind can refer to the subtle body at large. In general, in the, if we look at the third canto of the Bhagavatam Sankhya section, if we see the various elements of material nature, they are differentiated primarily based on their functional characteristics, not on their structural characteristics. Functional means what do they do? Structural means what are they made up of? So mind, intelligence, ego, the differentiation between them is primarily in functional terms. It's like if I have a computer in which I have a normal software, then I have a virus, which is corrupting. Now from the software perspective, if I look at the code, if the normal softwares which are helping my computer function, they are also codes and the virus is also codes. So from the structural perspective, both of them are codes. But from the functional perspective, their function is very different. One will help my computer function better, the virus will stop my computer from functioning. So like that, the differentiation between mind, intelligence and ego, it's primarily in functional terms, not so much in structural terms. The mind, intelligence, ego, they are all subtle matter and they function differently. So why I'm talking about this is that we all have certain abilities and certain inabilities. So some people are musically very, they have very sharp ear. Some people are what is called tone deaf. They just, you know, it's not that they're deaf, they're tone deaf. So tone deaf means, you know, they just can't make any musical sense of anything. So no matter how much they try, it's just that it just doesn't make sense. So I happen to be tone deaf also. So what happens is, if somebody is musically very sharp and somebody is tone deaf, and the two of them come together. Now, sometimes, you know, the kirtan is going on and a tone deaf person comes and picks up a karta and starts playing. And this person has closed his eyes and is blissful. But people around are miserable. What are you doing? So, the mind gives us certain by mind I'm using the generically for the gross, for the subtle body, everything. So the mind is endowed with certain abilities and it has certain inabilities, and these shape our perception of things. So a tone deaf person just can't perceive music. A musically sharp person can't not perceive music. If somebody tells me, don't worry, man, just focus on the Hare Krishna. How can I focus? This is wrong. This kartal is wrong. This can't tolerate. For me, this happens with English spellings. Now, anywhere I come, in any room, even if it's a temple hall, I look at all the notices and notice all the spellings. And I start noticing the spelling mistakes. This is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And if I tell someone, most of the time, everybody understands. Why don't you understand? So, now there are two concepts. There is being insensitive and being desensitized. Being insensitive means to not care for others. Being desensitized means not having that sensibility itself, not having the capacity to perceive that. So somebody is playing, say, music out of tune, or somebody is typing a letter with spelling mistakes. Now somebody else gets very irritated. Why are you typing it like this? It's not that this person wants to annoy the other person. This person doesn't have that faculty itself. It's okay. What does it matter? So, quite often conflicts happen because one person is desensitized to something and the other person thinks, why are you so insensitive? Like some people, they are just not cleanliness conscious. Just come to a place and after 15 minutes it appears as a storm has come in that place. You know, what happened? And somebody else comes, hey, why is thing unclean? Oh, is it unclean? I didn't notice only. Now they are not being irritating. They just don't notice things. So in modern psychology, they say some people lack a cleanliness gene. They try to attribute everything to genes, which is not exactly accurate. But the point is that there are some people who are just desensitized to certain things. And it is not that they want to irritate somebody else, but it doesn't register in their mind only. So things are unclean out there. Things are musically not sound, or musically it's off tune. Things are, spellings are wrong. But now that is a fact out there. But their subtle body is shaped in such a way that that problematic thing doesn't register in their consciousness only. The subtle body doesn't see it at all. So all of us have, based on the nature of our subtle body, the nature of our mind, certain sensitivities and certain, we could say, we have sensibility, or we have capacity to perceive things, certain things very sharply, and we just don't have the capacity to perceive certain things. And this creates often misunderstanding, because some people can perceive, some people can't perceive. And I'll elaborate on this theme further tomorrow, but I'll talk about two more points with respect to the mind now, and then we'll have some question answers. In the mind, when we function, there are two aspects. There are instincts and there are impulses. So instincts refer to programmed intelligence. Both instincts and impulses, they are both done unthinkingly. So for example, say I'm speaking right now, and if I touch this, And suppose it happens that there's electric current over here. Now, I won't have to think, oh, there's electric current, it will harm me. As soon as I touch it, immediately my hand moves away. So this is instinct. So instincts are provided by us, to us by nature for our survival and for our subsistence. So animals have phenomenal level of instincts also. And sometimes some instincts of animals may be far, far more more developed than human instincts. You know, if you take a human being and put him in an unknown city, you know, without a Google map or something, you don't know where to go. But there are birds which are expert at migration, and you blindfold them and put them in a distant land, they just zoom up, circle round, and then straight go back to their home. So this directional intelligence is given to them by nature. So instinct is programmed intelligence. And so in a sense, it is intelligence, but there is no exercise consciously of one's intellectual faculty to exhibit it. So for example, somebody who doesn't have a very good musical instinct, they may have to hear, you know, so person with a good musical instinct, even without even putting much effort, hey, this is off tune. Oh, is it? Somebody else who doesn't have that much instinct has to hear. Oh, yeah, it's a little going off tune. Somebody who has a very good language instinct, hey, there's so many mistakes here. Oh, what mistakes? Somebody else, you have to carefully read it, then you find the mistakes. So our instincts are actually what differentiate us in terms of our abilities. So a Brahmana's instincts are different from a Kshatriya's instincts. We know the famous incident in the Mahabharata where the Pandavas, when they were incognito, Arjuna won the hand of Draupadi. And then Drupada wanted to know, who is my son-in-law actually? Is he a Brahmana, Kshatriya, what? So he invited them for a banquet. And then in the hall where they were having the feast, they kept some scriptures, some weapons, some currency, some trade related things, and some artisan's tools. And the Pandavas, as soon as they came, they went straight to the weapons. They picked up the weapons, hey, this weapon is like this, and started, became immersed in discussion. So as soon as, now Drupada and Drishtadyumna, they were observing from another room, they had to say, these are Kshatriyas. So here what has happened? Pandavas are devotees, but still they didn't instinctively go towards scripture, because our defining relationship with Krishna is through our service to Krishna, and our service is determined by our nature. So they are Kshatriya, so they immediately went to the weapons. So we are all differentiated by our instincts. Now I have not found in our scripture any specific term which equates with instinct and impulse, this difference. Broadly, you could say we have vritti and vasana. Because vritti is the tendency or nature that can be called as the instinct. This is a very approximate term because these are two very different ways of looking at the world. But for our understanding, we can take from both and we can get a working understanding for ourselves. We can never get an exhaustive understanding, but a working understanding. So all of us get certain instincts. So a Kshatriya, loves to manage, control, get things done. A Brahmana loves to sit, analyze, study, discuss. That's their instinct naturally. So all of us have certain instincts. Instinct means we gravitate towards certain things and we are good at that thing without even much conscious thought about it. So in both instinct and in impulse, we don't exercise our intelligence consciously. But we act. But with respect to instinct, we act right. With respect to impulse, we act wrong. Impulse means that is also in the subtle body only, but it pushes us towards doing certain things. Say, as soon as if we see some food, I want to eat it. As soon as we enjoy some attractive looking image, I want to see it. So we all have certain sense objects towards which we may be attracted, and our impulses push us towards that. And often impulse is work against our intelligence. That means that the impulses make us do things which are bad for us. In certain countries in the West, Europe and some other places, the countries are welfare states. Welfare states means that if a person is not able to get a job, then the government pays for that person, to maintain that person. Now many times some people become drug addicts and they don't take a job and the government pays them dole for their maintenance, and they take this money and instead of getting food, they take drugs. The body is starving but they are taking drugs. So what has happened? The mind, which is uncontrolled, can be the enemy not just of the soul but even of the body. So the instincts work for self-preservation, but the impulses often work for self-destruction. So our impulses are what need to be controlled. So now when we practice bhakti, we have instincts, we have impulses. And based on the kind of instincts or the kind of impulses we have, we all have a certain kind of perception. So I, the soul, am here, the world is out here, my senses are here through which I am interacting. But in the mind, which is in between, there are certain instincts and certain impulses. And these shape how I will perceive things. So some people have a very well-developed aesthetic sense. So you know, okay, this looks good, this looks beautiful, this doesn't look that beautiful. They have that aesthetic sense. This is instinct. Some people, okay, it all looks the same, it all looks good. But you know, even good, there are degrees of goodness. This is very good, this is not that good. But some people just don't have that sense. So, but some people, you know, for them looking good is simply equated with that which triggers their sensual desires. So for them it is not an instinct which is appreciation of aesthetic beauty. It is simply an impulse for sensual gratification. So in either case, it's the way we perceive the world with our eyes that is different. But so our instincts actually help us to perceive properly even without conscious effort. And if the instincts are not there, then we can't perceive so easily. We are required to put some effort. The impulses, on the other hand, distort perception. When a person is impulsive, so I was at one mental health care center in America. I gave a talk over there. Now in India, we would crudely refer to a mental health care center as a pagal khana. But it's not exactly the same. The people there are not mad. Actually, when you say somebody has to be requires mental health care, when does a person need mental health care? Their idea is that, see, all of us have certain impulsive responses. All of us, say for example, get angry. Now when some people get angry, they just become sullen and become cold and unresponsive. They just don't talk with anyone. Some people, they get angry and talk too much. They start shouting at others, blasting at others. Some people, when they get angry, they don't just shout, they attack others. Start beating others. Some people, you know, when they get angry, especially in America where gun laws are relatively free, just pick up a gun and shoot. Now when we travel and preach, we do long drives because we go from one place to another. Either we fly or we drive. So one devotee driver was telling me that when he got his driving license, they told him that if any driver is driving very unpredictably, zooming round and round and round, driving crazily, so he says, if you suspect that he's drunk or he's disturbed, don't go close to him. Just inform the cops. He says that because, you know, many people have guns, you just honk a person. And you know, in India, you know, we press the horn quite often. In the West, you never press a horn. In fact, if you press a horn, that means the other person has done a serious mistake. And if somebody presses a horn at you, it's considered an insult to you. How dare? Do you think I don't know driving? So in India, we write horn, please. So again, what has happened is, Now people are very sensitized to traffic laws and people drive very carefully. In India, people are very desensitized. So because of that, we have to press the horn, blow the horn. So anyway, the point which I was making is, if you blow a horn and that other person gets angry, that person will just have a gun and take out the gun and shoot you. It's called road rage. So people get angry and they shoot. So the point which I'm making is, all of us, anger is a weakness which is there in every one of us. But based on our impulses, what kind of impulses we have, how we express the anger will vary. So I give four examples. I just become sullen and uncommunicative, I shout at others, I hit out at others, and I shoot others. So now, when does a person need mental health care? When their impulses become harmful for others. So everybody has lust in them. That is just common to everyone. But when, because of lust, a person starts assaulting someone else, then that person becomes a criminal. Everybody has greed in them. And because of greed, people want to accumulate. But when one wants to accumulate by cheating and exploiting and extorting others, that becomes excessive. Everybody feels depressed. But when that depression becomes destructive, then that person needs medical health care. So the point I'm making is, the impulses that are there within us, the impulses, how bad they have become, that determines whether a person needs mental health care or not. So I met a person in this mental health care. He was a double PhD from Ivy League universities. That means like a double doctorate from IITs in India. And somehow, what happened was, he was a brilliant person, but his friend who was actually simply a master's. And his friend got a better paying position as a faculty than him. And because of that, he went into depression. And that's why he was in this mental health care center. So, now, the point which I'm making is, we all have certain impulses. And when those impulses grow wild, then we can't function properly. So for us, we have been given certain instincts which we can develop. But the instincts are largely what we have. Now, a person who is tone deaf cannot become a musical genius. It's very, very difficult. But we can train and improve our instincts a little bit. But most of our self-mastery is in terms of training and regulating our impulses. So the impulses distort our perception. The impulses make us act unintelligently. Instincts enable us to act intelligently without even using our intelligence consciously, without thinking. So we all, when we work, we interact with each other, we all have different instincts and different impulses. And all of us have to manage it. So we have to help each other curb our impulses, and we have to help each other strengthen our instincts or channel and use our instincts. And to the extent we understand this, now some person may have very disciplined impulses, may not get angry with anyone, and somebody else just gets angry immediately. Say, why are you so short-tempered? And the other person say, why don't you get excited about anything? You know, you are just so unemotional about everything. You don't care for anything at all. So mutual understanding requires understanding that we all, at the level of soul, we are similar, but at the level of the mind, we are all different. And there are certain differences that can be changed, certain differences can't be changed. So instincts can't be changed much. Impulses can be changed, but they also require a time. Now for somebody, anger might be a very strong impulse, and it may take a long time for that person to control it. For somebody, anger might not be a very strong impulse. It may take less time. But when we understand that all of us have our own sets of impulses and instincts with which we are working. So we often compare, you know, I can keep things clean. Why can't you keep things clean? I may be able to keep things clean, but you know, I may be very forgetful of things. I forget, I had to go here, I had to go there, I had to go there. And that person may be able to remember things very well. So when we compare, often we compare our strengths with others' weaknesses. We feel, you know, you are so incompetent. But, you know, if others have weaknesses, we should compare their weaknesses with our weaknesses. Our weakness may not be in that field, it may be in some other field. So just as, say, I have to struggle to remember, similarly, this person has to struggle to keep things clean. That doesn't mean that person should always stay unclean or I should always keep forgetting. But just as I need help, I need assistance, I need training. Similarly, this person needs help, assistance, training. So in this way, if we understand that all of us have our own minds which limit us in certain ways and which endures in certain ways, then we can become more understanding of each other. And the more we become understanding of each other, the less there will be avoidable conflicts. And with this, we can actually progress more smoothly in our service, in our relationship with each other, in our service to Krishna, and in our journey towards spiritual growth. So tomorrow I'll talk more about specifically how these instincts and impulses within us lead to a judgmental mentality and how that can cause unnecessary problems in our interactions with others in outside devotee community and within the devotee community also. I'll summarize what I spoke today. I spoke about how the mind messes up our relationships. And in that, first I explained what is the mind. The mind is the channel through which the soul's consciousness goes to the outer world. So the mind is the integrator of the perceptions coming from the senses, like a monitor which brings in the images from the security camera. Now, so the mind, whichever is the sense that is giving us the most attractive impulse, that captures the mind, and then that's what we focus on. The perception in the mind can come from external perception, the images on the mind can come from external perception or from internal recollection also. And we are different from our mind in that the mind is the inner screen and we are the inner seer of that screen. And based on our particular nature, we have certain instincts. Instincts means that among the various windows on the mind's monitor, where we will zoom on reflexively, that is determined by our instincts. So instincts are like programmed intelligence. We act rightly without consciously thinking about it. And different people have different instincts. So somebody who has a very sharp instinct for something and somebody has a blunt instinct, the two will find difficult to get along. Not because the two can't, because the two are bad or the incompatible, but just that one of them is super sensitive, the other is desensitized. So, similarly, within our subtle body also are impulses. So, instincts are, we act intelligently without thinking, whereas with impulses, we act unintelligently without thinking. So, impulses are like our vasana, they impel us to do destructive things. And when we want to control our mind, that means we want to channel our instincts constructively and we need to control our impulses. So when we are interacting with each other, all of us have our particular set of instincts and impulses which direct our perceptions in certain ways. And because different people are going to perceive differently, so rather than blaming others for the way they are seeing or acting, we have to understand that their set, their mind is different, their instincts and impulses are different, and that's why some things which are obvious to me may not be obvious to them. And rather than comparing their weaknesses with our strengths, we can compare their weaknesses, the things which they find difficult to do, with some other things which we find difficult to do. And in that way, we can become more understanding of each other and we can progress more harmoniously in our relationships and in our service to Krishna. So, are there any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu. Yes.
Thank you for a very wonderful analysis of the mind and its problems. My question is related to this instinct and impulses. Basically, what I understood as vritti and vasana, it's propensity. And vasana is
craving or
craving. Yeah. Looking at myself and also at so many devotees we deal with or with our own children. Over a period of years, when we look at somebody, including ourselves or the people whom we deal with, we see that this instinct and impulse, it hardly changes actually. As in, Even after taking to personal devotional service, perhaps we're not practicing bhakti properly or whatever. But even after several years, we see the person who has a tendency to be verbally abusive in a relationship tends to keep falling to that. The person who is lusty and has sexual issues, challenges, he keeps repeating that mistake again and again. The person who has a problem in dealing with money because of greed, he tends to keep doing that. So, at least after several years, I started feeling that maybe all these discussions which are obviously there in the Shastra, one thing certainly everybody can do is, with all this analysis and help, one can at least understand one's own vritti and vasana. Perhaps that itself is a very big achievement, that you understand what is your, you know, basic set of instincts and basic set of impulses where you are weak. So that perhaps is possible. But personally, I have kind of actually lost hope that it can actually be reformed, as in, especially the impulse part. Vritti part, yes, because you mentioned that as an instinct in terms of the varna. Maybe that polishing is, and an example that you gave was very appropriate, the Pandavas. But whether this vasana can actually be, over a long time, a person can change. I personally have lost hope in that. So, any point?
So, can we actually change our impulses even after practicing bhakti? Still, the impulses seem to be there. If a verbally abusive person still remains abusive. Yeah, to some extent, we start our bhakti with unrealistic expectations. We start thinking that bhakti is like a brush that is going to whitewash me. You know, right? Like everything about me is going to be changed. Pure, sparkling, attractive me is going to emerge. Well, that doesn't happen. In fact, sometimes initially when we start practicing bhakti, we may curb our vasanas because of the initial newness and attractiveness of bhakti. But many devotees, after 10, 15, 20 years, they start finding that, you know, the old me starts reappearing. Not necessarily in always a negative sense, but it is that the who we essentially are, that is going to be there. So, especially in youth, we may have the passion to fight against our nature. But as we grow a little older, we get tired of fighting against our nature. It just takes too much effort. So we don't want to work for our nature. We don't want to work against our nature. We want to work with our nature for Krishna. So I would say everything when we do analysis, the categorization is very smooth. Say, in general, taxonomy is a system of classification. So, taxonomy on paper and taxonomy on reality is very different. See, on a map, if you see the map of America, they have divided the states almost like squares. But you know, actually, if you go across a state border, there's no line over there. So, is this river in this state or that state? No, is this tree in this state or that state? It's not always so clearly differentiated. So systems of classification, in concept, they are categories clear. This is here, this is here. But in reality, there can always be porous boundaries, as they say. So similarly, what are impulses and what are instincts? In terms of conceptual analysis, I categorize the two. But in terms of reality, it may not be so easy to differentiate. So for example, somebody is a business person. And now Prabhupada says, Sarvarambhai Doshena Dhumenag Nirvavrata, in connection with that. All endeavors are covered by faults. So, in that connection, he says, those who are business people, sometimes they have to speak some untruths. Just that's the way of business. Now, some people speak untruth consciously after thinking, you know, this is what I have to speak. Some people, just off the tongue, untruth slips off. Now, they're not bad people. But that's just the way that their intelligence, you know, isko ye bolna hai, isko wo bolna hai. You speak here, speak this here, speak that there, and they get things done. For them, speaking the truth is a very important concern for a Brahmana. But for a Vaishya, you know, getting things done is important. That doesn't necessarily mean even a Vaishya will have his or her own limits. Everybody has our own moral limits. But what those moral limits are, that will vary from person to person. So, we can't expect that to change drastically. So for example, there are some lies which are not really very harmful lies. Some lies are very harmful. They're malicious, they're meant to hurt others, and they are actually... So even within lies, there can be degrees. So some people shout. They just have, as you said, some people are verbally abusing. But some people just shout, and you know, that is the impulse which comes upon them. But they don't hold the grudges. Like, you know, some people, they say that I'm not a morning person. That means when they wake up, they're always in a bad mood. And they just feel glum when they wake up. Now, if a person who is not very cheerful when they wake up, if you start talking with them, hey, we have to do this, we have to do that, they just blast out. But you know, that same person, you meet them later in the day, they're much more reasonable. So what happens is, there are certain things about us which are not so easy to change. So that does not necessarily mean that is a vasana which is uncontrollable. See, as long as it does not make us violate the dharmic limits. Now, what is the dharmic limit for whom? For a Brahmana, the dharmic limit may be different from a Vaishya. But all of us have certain... as long as we don't transgress the limits of dharma, then there will be variation. Some people are very soft-spoken. And some people, just for them to get things, then they have to shout. Now, after some time, you know, this person shouts, but they don't get angry. They're not really angry or they're not mad at me. So we get to understand each other. And that way, so I would say that there are certain aspects of us which are very, very difficult to change. And trying to change that requires so much effort that other changeable aspects, we don't have energy left to change them. So it's very important for us over a period of time to take stock and to understand which aspects of mine are most important for me to change. And not just most important for me to change, somebody else may tell me this is very important, but I may feel it's impossible. So then which are most doable for me? So gradually we move onwards, and then we may ourselves learn. So others learn to live, we have to learn, this is what I am, and I will live with this aspect. And others also learn to live with that aspect. But there are certain other aspects which we work on changing. So both the extreme, that thinking that bhakti will change everything and bhakti will change nothing, I think both are wrong. Bhakti will change. Ultimately what bhakti changes is our purpose of life. I may have been short-tempered, but I have been short-tempered materialistic person. Now I am still short-tempered, but I am a short-tempered Vaishnava. Or at least sadhak, Vaishnava sadhak. My goal has changed. So impulses and instincts come up within us. But what is ours is our intention. So bhakti strengthens our intention. And then how much the impulses and instincts come and how we manage them, that is something which is an individual battle for every one of us to face. Okay? Thank you. Yes, yes, sir. Okay.
Hare Krishna. Guruji, in our service, when you have service to guide other devotees, especially those who are working, so one challenge which I face is, sometimes, you know, when devotees, when they undergo some misery, let's say someone is not having a job or something, then one gets so much absorbed in that misery that one doesn't practice Krishna words properly. So how to see that we have to deal with our misery, we have to deal with the problems, but at the same time, our basic practice or the basic absorption of Krishna Maharshi Prabhu. Because why is the tendency to get absorbed in the misery?
Yeah. So if we face problems, then how can we ensure that we still practice our Krishna consciousness? It is artificial to expect that our material life will not affect our spiritual life. The soul is covered in three cases: the body, the society and the environment. And all these three affect the soul's capacity to function in the world. When we have many of these Hindu functions where at the end they say Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, they say three times. You know why three times? Because you know the soul is in these three coverings: the body, the society and the environment. So from the body we get Adi Bhautik, Adi Atmik Klesh. From the society we get Adi Bhautik Klesh. And from the environment we get Adi Daivik Klesh. So the idea is Om Adi Atmik Klesh Shanti. Om Adi Bhautik Klesh Shanti. Om Adi Daivik Klesh Shanti. So all these, the soul has to function in this world through these coverings. And the upheavals in these coverings are going to affect the soul's capacity to function. And because we are going to serve Krishna in this world, so naturally the ups and downs in this world are going to affect us. So, in fact, when I was in Melbourne, I gave a whole series of seminars on emotionally healthy spirituality. Emotionally healthy spirituality means it is artificial to expect that our emotions will not affect us at all. Now, if we lose a loved one, then that is a big loss. And to think that, you know, I understand we are souls and we are temporarily in this world and nothing should be. It doesn't work like that. If you see, there is a loss over there and there is a process of, in the Vedic tradition also, there is a whole process for grieving. Unless the emotion is channeled through grief, the emotion will choke us. Even the Mahabharata, we see that when Abhimanyu is killed, Arjuna breaks down and cries. Arjuna lashes out at his brothers. He says, are all your weapons like bangles? Couldn't you protect your my son? Even he turns and lashes out at Krishna. Krishna, you must have known what happened. Why didn't you tell me? Now, Krishna is not sanctimonious over this. My plan is perfect, don't doubt me. Krishna is understanding. Krishna, you know, he's just supportive, understanding, commiserating. So there are natural human emotions which will come in particular situations. So we have to accept that and we have to work with that. So naturally our spiritual life will be affected. Even in the Lamrut, when Prabhupada was in Allahabad, Prabhupada had this pharmacy, he was giving the medicines and there was another doctor who would give the prescribed medicine, Prabhupada would dispense the medicines. So this doctor says to when he's talking about Prabhupada, he says, Swamiji was a very religious man, but at that time he had only one concern: how can I earn more money? How can I earn more money? At that time, that was Prabhupada's driving concern. Now he wanted to assist his spiritual master's mission. He wanted to finish his household responsibilities so that he could serve Krishna, serve his guru more. But whatever. So our material situation will affect us. And the magnitude to which it will affect will vary based on our particular nature. Some people are very sensitive to cold. So you know, if the weather becomes very cold, somebody else it doesn't make any much difference. But for them, that Adi Daivik Klesh is too much to bear. So somebody, they have so much cold that, you know, if they just come out of the house, they start getting pain in the legs and everything. And for them, so we have to understand, this is the machine I have and this is the machine I have to work with. So for some people, they are very, very shaken by relationships. If something goes wrong in their relationship, they become very disturbed. Some people, with respect to health, if something goes wrong in their body, they become very disturbed. Some people, so doctors also say that, you know, different people have different capacities to bear pain. So it does not necessarily mean that one is transcendental to the body. No, it's just that different people have different capacities. Prabhupada in Tamal Krishna Maharaj writes in TKJ's diary that, you know, Prabhupada would moan in pain in the last few days. Now, it is not that a pure devotee does not feel physical pain. A pure devotee's purpose is not affected by the physical pain. The determination to serve Krishna is there. But the pain is just a function of the body. And that will be there. So the point which I am making is that based on our particular body-mind nature, we all will be more vulnerable to some particular disturbances, whether it be in the body, in the society or in the environment. And we have to acknowledge this. And actually, it is our association that has to work as a shock absorber. Means we need to have friends who understand us. Some devotees, you know, some loud one passes away and others may say, why are you so attached? Well, that is not the way to function. That is a time when there is a loss and there is a healthy way to deal with that loss. So we have to have around us in the broad devotee community some friends who understand our sensitivities and who help us deal with that. So it's important that our mind is of a particular way and somebody else's mind is of an entirely different way. They will just not understand what we are going through. So whatever are the issues that we are facing, we need to have the like-minded association which helps us understand. So basically, we need someone who understands our mind and who helps us to understand our mind. They understand our mind. Okay, this is how you are thinking. So some people, you know, when they study philosophy, they have a lot of doubts coming up. Now this question, that question, others say, why do you think so much? You know, you are a bhakta, don't be a jnani. But you know, it doesn't work for them like that. They have to, their mind just, this question comes, they will think, how don't you get this question? It's so obvious. So for them, they need somebody who is intellectual. Okay, huh, you get this question like this. Yeah, I also got this question. And you know, this is how I resolve this issue. So for our material situation, whatever it is we get, we need understanding devotees. So they help us. First of all, our mind is the only mind we have. The mind is not like a replaceable part. Well, if my mind gets upset by certain things, it gets upset. I can't wish away the emotions of the mind. I have to deal with them, but I can't wish them away. Those emotions are there. So somebody else who also gets similar emotions and they have dealt with those emotions, they can understand why I am feeling like this. And they can, based on their experience, their reading of Shastra, they can explain to me, okay, how to deal with this. So when difficulties come, we need like-minded association to go through those difficulties while remaining steady in our bhakti. Okay? Thank you. Okay. Where is... Okay, the mic is here. Okay, fine.
During the way you explained our inward senses, mind and soul. Mind acts like a storehouse for all the experiences and perceptions we see.
Yeah.
So then what about brain? When someone has injury in brain, they also lose memory and all such cases.
Okay.
What this organ exactly?
Okay. So if the mind is an integrator of the sensory inputs, then what is the role of the brain? See, the brain is the physical organ which is required for information processing. Just like somebody may be a very good singer. That means that singing ability is there within their subtle body. But if they have a sore throat, they can't sing. So we need, if the ability itself is stored at the subtle level, but we need a physical tool for exercising that ability. Somebody may be a very good dancer. Now dancing is not simply about moving the hands and legs. You know, yeah, but there is an aesthetic sense inside which enables the hands and legs to be moved in a very nice way. So somebody may still have that aesthetic sense, but if the body is damaged, they got a fracture or something, they can't dance. So similarly, the brain is the physical tool. The line becomes slightly blurred because with respect to the brain is also the seat of memory. So it's like there is a software in the computer, but there is also the hardware. And in the hardware, we may have we have memory unit. So the brain is the place where the memory unit is there. And the brain, you could even say, is like the CPU. The memory is there, CPU is there. It's very important. So I have written a book, Demystifying Reincarnation, where I talk about, and I'll be speaking on it today evening. So I talk about cases of hydranencephaly. Hydranencephaly is where people, where there are children who were born, they have practically no brain substance. You know, in their cranial cavity, cerebrospinal fluid is not around the brain; it is present instead of the brain. So they have nothing. You know, they have practically less than, some of them have less than 5% brain substance. And still, there was a Dr. John Lorber. He is a member of the Nobel Laureate Committee. he published a paper in Science magazine, and there he wrote, the paper's title was, "Is Your Brain Really Necessary?" So he gave many cases of people who had no brain substance, brain less than 5% brain substance, and still they were functioning normally. In University of Sheffield, there was a graduate who was studied by the John Lorber, and he had a very high IQ, and yet he had less than a very small percentage of the brain he had. So in some exceptional cases, that ability can function even without the structural tool. Just like some, there are some blind people who can see, you know. No, there are on YouTube, there are some videos also. Now we have, in our tradition, we have some devotional poets, you know, who couldn't see, but they knew how the Lord was dressed. So in some, like in outer body experiences also, what happens is the sensory faculty is not working, but the mind also has its eyes. The mind has subtle senses within it. And in extraordinary situations, the mind's subtle senses can perceive even without the gross senses functioning. But that is extraordinary. Normally, the mind's subtle senses need the gross senses to function. So similarly, normally we need the brain to function. But the brain alone is not the storehouse of memory. The brain alone is not the tool where, by which recollection and conscious perception happen. Sometimes it can happen without the brain also. The brain is simply the physical tool which is normally required. Thank you. Okay. Till what time should we go on today? I mean, okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you really for hearing another brilliant class. My question is in continuation to his discussion, Shoguru's question, and this is more from the community's perspective now. So Prabhupada asked a question about whether impulse can be changed or not, and you very nicely clarified the purpose of bhakti. And not having undue expectation from bhakti in actually wanting the impulses to be changed. And you clarified that ultimately it will clarify our, it will clean our intentions and redefine the purpose of life. And then you made a nice point there that as long as it does not transgress dharma. Now my question begins there. So let's say somebody's impulses are transgressing dharma. I'm talking about that scenario. Now there are three levels. One, as probably said, that even to become aware of our impulses would also be a very good achievement.
Yeah.
Second is to be able to manage our impulses. And third is to be able to change our impulses. Which in one sense is indirectly accepted when it is transgressing dharma, then changing impulse may be needed. Either by one's own effort or by external help, which is where you talked about mental health care. Now, my question is this. In fact, I'm just building a background before. So education, hearing lectures and self-introspection, etc. can help change one's impulses if one is self-motivated, you know, and has that ability to be able to bring a conscious change in oneself by hearing lectures, right? Now, as far as others are concerned, not everybody in society is like that, and will change by hearing, or will change by hearing lecture, or will self-motivated enough to be able to change impulses. Now, majority of people in the society will fall in other category. And ISKCON being a hospital and ISKCON being a university, we also want to make sure that we help others changing their impulses, right? So now, how will somebody else be able to change impulses? When I'm saying somebody else, I'm talking about those people for whom lectures are not enough and who are not self-motivated enough. Okay, I'm talking about those set of people. Now there, if their impulses are harming themselves, then by getting some feedback, they'll be able to change their impulses. For example, when I become angry, I bang my head against the wall. Now after banging for 3-4 years, I realize that I am harming myself only, and therefore perhaps I may change my impulse because I am harming myself. Now let us say, now I'm talking about the 2B, that category of people who are harming others because of their impulses. I believe their impulse can get changed by culture. That's where the role of culture comes in. Then they will also get a feedback by the community of devotees, by the culture of devotees, or the culture of society. They will get some feedback by which they will be able to change their impulses which is harming others. Now my question is, first of all, is this a right understanding? That for such people who are not self-motivated, for whom lectures are not enough, and who are harming others by their impulses, the role of culture becomes important. Question 1. And question 2, in a society of devotees, typically any other devotee, because he is a Vaishnava, he sees that no problem, we have heard this lecture, so we understand this how mind works, and therefore they don't give feedback which was necessary to be able to change that impulse for somebody who is not self-motivated. So how does this, from a community perspective, from a community of devotees perspective, how does this problem get addressed? Let me summarize.
Okay. So, when people are not self-motivated enough to just change themselves by hearing, then is it that culture will change their impulses, or is it that the feedback from others should it be given so that the impulses will change? Yeah. Culture is gradually meant to, we could say, osmotically or organically shape people's behavior. Sometimes we learn some culture. No, okay, this is what you should do, this is what you should not do. But a lot of culture is learned simply by observing. Oh, this is how this person behaves, this is what this person behaves. So many times culture is like blood. Now we don't normally know that blood is flowing in our body. We know it, but we don't really are not conscious of it. But when blood gets cut and starts flowing out, then you start realizing, hey, something is wrong over here. So like that, culture is something which is innate. And people start, as they come into a community, they observe, okay, this is how everybody behaves, this is how I should behave. We all learn that. And do in Rome as Romans do, as it is said. So we all have to, we all do learn certain things by culture. Now, the certain impulses can be observed. We see others doing certain things and we learn to rein in those impulses. Say for example, if I have a tendency to speak very loudly, and in a community where everybody is speaking very softly, I may just initially keep speaking loudly, but then I notice everybody, I speak loudly, this person responds softly. And gradually that gets it, I should speak softly. So culture can teach in a subtle way like that. Now as far as giving feedback for helping others whose impulses are harming others, harm is a very extendable term. You know, what do we mean by how exactly is it harming others? We'll have to see. So there is the principle of tolerance, and there is the principle of discipline or law. So in certain situations, certain impulses may be tolerated more, and in certain situations, oh no, this will not work. So I would say this is a matter of each community will have its own ethos over there. Some places, you know, even a little impulse going wrong, strong feedback is given. Some places, you know, a lot of things go wrong, after that some gentle feedback is given. So each of them has its advantages and disadvantages. Generally, even if some strong feedback is given and that person may temporarily curb that particular impulse, but whether that impulse is getting changed, whether it is getting reformed, that we really don't know. So, or sometimes it may happen if you get strong feedback, that person just leaves and goes away. So we have to balance between protecting that person's Bhakti Lata beach and protecting other people's Bhakti Lata beach also. So in general, Western and Westernized cultures are more non-hierarchical, where they're more horizontal. So in general, in Western and Westernized cultures, people don't give much feedback to each other. Now you live the way you are, I live the way I am. And now, of course, in every culture, there are certain things which are not to be done. And for that, we may get some feedback. But in general, authority is de-emphasized. In many traditional cultures, they are more hierarchical, and authority is very much emphasized. So we all are trying to practice a traditional way of living, but we all have come from an upbringing which is to different degrees westernized. So we will have to find out how best we can serve Krishna and what is the social environment in which our Bhakti Lata beach can flourish. So sometimes feedback may help us, sometimes it may hurt us. See, it also I have a whole seminar on fault finding or correcting, but I'll take two main points in this. See, there is in each of us there is a side which is confident, yes I can do it, and there is a side which is diffident, no, what if I can't do it. So you know, the side which feels that I can improve, I can do better, I can achieve this, and the side which says no, you won't be able to do it. So now when somebody gives me feedback, you should not do like this, if I have the basic confidence that I can improve, then I will be, that feedback will help me, because oh yes, I can learn this and I can do it. But if I am myself very diffident, and then on top I get corrective feedback, and I feel already I am struggling, I can't do this also, and I am told you have to do this also, better I'll give this up only, so I'll not do it. So that's why our goal always has to be to help people rise from where they are to one step up. And sometimes feedback may push them down from where they are also, because that feedback may so much discourage them. And sometimes that feedback is what is necessary. Okay, this is what I am meant to do, and this is how I can do it. So we have to actually, in general, it is not good to give feedback to those whom we don't know very well, because first of all they will think that we are envious of them or something like that, and we may not know what they are going through when we give them feedback. So if somebody who knows them well and understands their situation, so there is the need to improve, and there is the ability to improve, or the will to improve. If the will to improve is itself not there, not in the sense of they don't want to change, but they don't have the confidence that I can change. See, what happens is, especially in organizations like ours, where everybody is a volunteer. In Wisconsin University, there was a survey done about writers. There was a group, there were students. So the boys formed a group, and they said that, now all of us, when we write, we will give corrective feedback. You know, this is good, not, you need to improve this, you need to improve this, you need to improve this. Now the girls, they also wanted to form a group, but they decided we will do exactly the opposite of what the boys are doing. They said, when we write, we will tell each other what is good in our writings. And then, they followed them 10-15 years down the line. And they found that there were these 15 boys, not one of them had become a professional writer. And 4 or 5 of them were known as very poor writers. And all of them, when they had to write, they would feel fear. What if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? Among these 15 girls, 3 of them had become published writers, and remaining 9 of them, they were known as very articulate writers in their social circles. And the remaining 2-3 of them, they were not very articulate, but still they were effortless, they would just write freely. So the point here is that just looking at the faults and pointing out the faults just took away their morale to write, and they stopped writing basically. On the other hand, an encouragement inspired them to write. So especially we are in a voluntary movement, and even if you say, okay, you are taking initiation and you have initiation vows, but ultimately if the devotee decides to become so disheartened, they stop practicing bhakti, the spiritual master, what can this? Spiritual master can't come with a gun, you have to follow your vows. So we are a voluntary movement. And if we give too strong a feedback, if that disheartens people, then they may just stop practicing. So we do need to give feedback so that people rise upwards. But sometimes some people, if for them to change is difficult, or for them to give feedback is difficult, then it may be better that we let them find a space where they can serve the way they want without affecting others. Or some people may be a little short-tempered, but then you know, then you'll not be put in a service where they are interacting with too many people. They interact with just one or two persons, and that person is a little thick-skinned. So if this person shouts, they are able to tolerate it. So I would say, rather than, it's not just giving feedback or not giving feedback, I would say along with giving feedback, it is the responsibility of the community and its leaders to create the necessary space where devotees can work with their conditionings to serve Krishna. So without that space, then a lot of devotees will feel just choked and they may give up practicing bhakti. This doesn't mean correction doesn't have to be done. Correction is required at times, constructive feedback is required, but it has to be given cautiously, trying to make sure that the person doesn't become disheartened in the practice of bhakti. So basic there, we have to make sure that we affirm their spiritual self-worth. That you know, you are a soul, you are a part of Krishna, and we very much want you to continue practicing bhakti. But in this particular situation, in this particular way you are acting, that is a little troublesome. So if we make sure that we affirm their spiritual self-worth and then point out their conditioning, then that is fine. But if somehow we criticize in a way that they start equating their conditioning with themselves, and they start feeling hopeless, then we are actually, our conditioning is doing a disservice to them. Na buddhi bhedam janayet ajnanam karma sanginam, Krishna says. Don't disturb the minds of the intelligent people. I was reading an Acharya's commentary on this verse. It's interesting, Prabhupada translates that don't disturb the minds of people. But the Sanskrit is, na buddhi bhedam janayet. Don't break the intelligence of people. What does it mean? The Sanskrit word is buddhi. Buddhi is not mana. Buddhi is intelligence. What it means is that we may have certain conceptions which we have formed with our mind. But then later, we use our intelligence to solidify those conceptions. Okay, this is the way I am, and this is the way I am going to function. So what happens is, if the intelligence itself is penetrated, then they have nowhere to go to. So we need to work with people's intelligence. We may say this is just a conditioning, but people's worldview is formed around what they are. And it's very, very difficult for us to be able to penetrate into that in a way that they don't feel threatened or they don't feel demeaned. So they have to feel affirmed, then they will be ready to accept the constructive feedback. So thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki, Gaur Premananda. Prabhupada ki.
A lot of talk about Ishtada Pragya.